Reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP.
Bottle of wine, fruit of the vine. When you gonna let me get sober? Let me go home and start over.
Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio. Brought to you in part by Recovery Centers of America, the nationally recognized leader in drug and alcohol treatment, using proven evidence-based treatment, including 24/7 medically supervised detox, inpatient and outpatient options. You'll receive exceptional care from an expert team of master-level clinicians, physicians, nurses, and staff using 12-step methodology and medications. Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region, a proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825, and Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, thanks for joining us, and welcome to the show. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. Hey, Mark, what's new in the recovery news this week?
There's a lot of recovery news. The first story came out about this new meth that has been going around. Law enforcement are seeing the emergence of a super powerful version of meth. 95% is produced in labs in Mexico. It's increasing deaths. And one of the things that they say is that deaths have increased from meth actually between 2008 and 2015, 250%. So as soon as we start taking our eye off the opioid epidemic, meth is going to be filling right in there.
Well, guess what? This week in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, they had a meth raid of that exact meth that came from Mexico. There was something like 100 pounds of meth and a lot of fentanyl. So it's good that's off the street.
Yeah, it's meth is a really bad drug. A lot of people end up in psych hospitals because of it. They go psychotic eventually.
Yeah.
It just ruins a lot of lives.
Absolutely. What else you have?
So a new study came out actually about magic mushrooms. If people are familiar, that's psilocybin, which is a psychedelic, right? What they're seeing is that it has a possible protective effect against opioids. It was actually a rather large study, and it showed a 17 to 32% less likely for somebody to get hooked on opioids if they had used mushrooms once in their life. Now, the crazy thing is there was another study that came out that found a 30% reduction. So right now, what they're thinking is psilocybin, which is in the ingredient in magic mushrooms, might interfere with the transmission of dopamine and serotonin in the brain. The psychedelic has also showed promise to get off alcohol and nicotine. I'm skeptical.
Well, first of all, what's the source? And the next thing I want to say, so all my friends that were taking psilocybin, magic mushrooms, it's been a big benefit for them today.
Yeah, I mean, it's. Are you saying that, Gary?
Yeah. What else you got? Okay. What else you got? That's too crazy.
Final one.
Yeah.
Traces of methamphetamine and other drugs that enter waterways are thought to be getting brown trout addicted. A study came out, and it's actually a known thing. What they're finding is that there's a lot of drugs in wastewater, right?
Yeah.
And in this one study, they looked at brown trout, like those seen downstream from wastewater facilities.
So are they seeing an increase of these brown trouts entering rehabs? I mean, that's what I'd like
to know. There's no rehab for it, but what they're seeing is that they're less active. They're going through withdrawal. They're having problems with finding food and reproducing. And, you know, all kidding aside, it's actually a very serious thing because what you're seeing is trace amounts of opioids, cocaine, methamphetamine hitting the water in these streams. And fish are very, very susceptible to getting hooked on this stuff.
And then we are eating the fish.
And then we're eating the fish.
Yeah, it's crazy. So, It's crazy.
So that's the news today, Gary.
That's the news. Well, they're great stories, Mark.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm not sure how true they are, but I think they're at the very least entertaining.
They're very true.
Right?
They're very true. They're all backed by sources.
And Mark, in recovery, we have to have fun also, right?
We do have to have fun also.
Right.
But I am worried about the trout. I'm a fisherman.
I get that. Hey, listen, when we come back, you know, we put out to our audience about, you know, helping us program today's show. And we have some great ideas, and we're gonna talk about them as soon as we come back from our break.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're struggling with alcohol or drugs, Recovery Centers of America can help. RCA's local inpatient and outpatient programs are founded on science and delivered with heart from an expert, caring team who will inspire and guide you every step of the way. Call 1-888-RECOVERY now to speak with a treatment advisor. At RCA, you'll be in a community that builds connections and fosters support from peers and RCA's team of medical professionals and recovery support specialists. At RCA's state-of-the-art campus in Devon, PA, and Mays Landing, New Jersey, they tailor your treatment to you and also offer specialized programs for patients with history of trauma, for patients who have achieved recovery but are experiencing a relapse, for young adults, adults 50 years and older, a confidential program for first responders and military, and a faith-based program. RCA answers the phone and accepts patients 24/7. And because it's local and in-network with insurance providers, treatment is affordable and accessible. Don't wait. Call 1-888-RECOVERY. Recovery today.
Hi, this is Bobby Rydell, and you're listening to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
You know, a good friend of our show, Bobby Rydell, passed this week, and I'd just like to recognize what an incredible entertainer, writer, performer, and we here at Clean and Sober Radio would like to send our condolences out to Bobby's wife, Linda, his kids, and his grandchildren. Rest in peace, Bobby Rydell.
Yeah, he was a great guy, and he was a great guest on the show.
He was fabulous. Okay, so we put out last night for our audience to help us come up with some suggestions for today's show. It's a different thing. It's fun. So we got a lot of responses. And let's try to fill the hour, Mark.
Oh, yeah, Gary. We always do.
I know we all do. Okay. So one of the people in the audience said, can you guys talk about stigma? Yeah, we can.
Yeah, I was actually just reading an article on Kurt Cobain from back in the 90s that overdosed on – I forget, did he OD or – I think he committed suicide.
I don't remember.
But this stigma, you know, is talking about how stigma might have held him back from really reaching out for help. And that's the thing about stigma. You know, thankfully, it seems like it's lifting somewhat at this point, but it's still definitely around.
I totally agree with your assessment of that. There was a nationwide poll and revealed that entrenched negative views of people who suffer from substance abuse disorder or who are in recovery were some of the most strongly held views coming from the state of Pennsylvania.
Really? What kind of views were they? Was it a negative?
All
view?
Negative.
All like, negative.
Let me
okay.
give you the national survey.
Sure.
71% of respondents believe that society at large considers individuals who use drugs problematically to be outcast or non-community members, which deters people with severe substance use disorders from accessing life-saving help. So the stigma, people are afraid to get treatment.
Yeah. And this is current.
This is current. 74% of respondents believe that society at large views individuals who use drugs problematically as somewhat, mostly, or entirely responsible for their own drug use. Are we responsible for our drug use?
So we're responsible for, I guess, the first using in the beginning, right? We're using in the beginning, but then something takes over. I talk to clients, you know, as a therapist, and, you know, we talk about how none of us expected to get addicted. Right. None of us expected to get addicted.
No,
and a lot of people had this picture of to be addicted, you had to be like living on the street or you had to, you know, be homeless. And so none of us knew. And we looked around and we were just trying to have fun like everybody else. But then, you know, there was some genetic predisposition, sometimes trauma and things like that, where we got addicted. And then at that point, at that point, once that takes over.
Well, I'm going to ask you, you as a clinician, can anybody identify the time when it went from fun to not fun? There had to be – I know it's a gradual thing, mm-hmm. but at some point it tips over and you're engulfed with this.
Yeah. we talk about that and we call them moments of clarity, right, where like you come face to face with some problems coming from it. But the thing that we're battling is denial. Right. Denial is so heavy. So even that could go on for a couple of years where bad things are happening. But somebody's like, well, this isn't because of my using. This is because this is going on. This is going on. And then it got a little out of control. But, you know, I'm just going to bring it back. So that denial makes it really hard to kind of connect the dots.
And in conjunction to that term, the denial term, I remember saying to myself, you know, let's say it's a summer. I'm going to stop right after Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to start. The new year is going to be a new year for me.
Yep.
But tomorrow never comes.
Yeah. Procrastination, right?
Yeah.
And definitely thinking like this was true, right? Like this is what's going to happen. And I'm going to exert control over this. And I remember always trying to find control, regain control. Like that's the usual battle before finally surrendering.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Hey, listen, guys, if you're just joining us now, Mark and I we're going to discuss a host of different subjects that our audience has brought up to us. We'll have a little fun with it. It'll be serious. And if you want to give a call, give us a call at 1-888-329-3306. We'd really love some people to call in and give us their views on the subjects that we're discussing. Yeah, that stigma, man, and it still goes on. I think you're correct that it's getting better, and maybe it's getting better because more people are addicted and more people now are aware of it, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's pretty disturbing, though, that article that you have, just showing how high the stigma really is still, you know, at this point in Pennsylvania.
well, 73% of respondents – this is another piece of this – believe that society at large – views individuals who are dependent on drugs as having moderate, low, or no chance of maintaining recovery. Boy, that's a pessimistic. Yeah. Is it true?
So, you know, when you look at long-term studies, most of the people that get treatment and continue getting treatment get better, right?
Yeah.
The problem is that a lot of people kind of lose hope and then they stop doing it. You know, they pull away from getting help. But the vast majority that actually stay connected, you know, will get better eventually. There's most definitely, most likely going to be multiple relapses before somebody probably gets it.
There's a lot of ifs in that. If they do this, if they do that,
yes.
And it can be a long term process to getting sober,
yeah.
Or you can be lucky and do it one shot.
Yes.
Who knows why?
Yeah, and you see sometimes that people do get it in one shot, but I'll tell you, the vast majority, it's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
In the beginning, you know.
Yeah, and you know, I'll tell you something. I one and done. They say,
yeah.
I did it one and done. You can start playing games in your head. If it was that easy to stop, that you're really not an addict.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. And especially just, you know, making comparisons and then that thought of like, well, maybe it was a stage in my life, right? And I've seen this disaster happen so many times. Like with clients I work with that, you know, they went a while and then they started thinking like this was just a stage in my life. And then they decided I can have one drink. Drinking was never a problem for me, right?
Yeah.
And then the whole darn thing comes back again.
Yeah. I mean, I still have people say to me, oh, I know you don't use drugs anymore, but you drink, don't you?
Me too.
No. You, right? You get, you get that.
Absolutely.
Because they don't know.
Yeah. And, you know, like, oh, well, drinking wasn't that bad for you.
Right.
You know, it's funny because people can, look at what's going on from an outside perspective and not see it, right? But only we know. Because we hid it so much.
Did we really hide it? I mean, I think I was pretty out there.
Well, you were all over the newspaper, Gary. So I'm pretty sure he was pretty out there.
I was over the newspaper or in the
newspaper?
You were
in the newspaper. I'm still trying to look for old articles from back then. I don't know if they still have them on the internet, but you know.
It's pretty long ago.
It is. I don't think they are.
I have all the articles. You know, Mark, a higher stigma induces were found in the low, middle, and upper middle class than the poorest and the richest demographics. For white people and non-white people. So the stigma mostly is in the middle of society and not in the lower economic people or the rich.
Interesting.
That is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I have no idea why that is.
Let me just continue. And that goes for, you know, white people. I hate to say white people, non-white. You know, for women, it's more for women than men. For older than younger people, and for city residents than suburban or rural residents.
More stigma?
Yes. Yeah.
For city residents?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
That is weird.
Is that what it says here? Yeah. Higher stigma? Yeah. Isn't that weird?
That is. You would think that there'd be less stigma.
In the center city.
You see more of it. Yeah.
Higher stigma perception was the most common among whites, self-identified Christians, and self-identified conservatives.
I'll tell you.
Now, that's a generalization, of course, but there must be some data. Brad's agreeing with that, actually. And Brad is a – Brad, if you have something to say, say it, man.
I don't have a microphone.
He doesn't have a microphone. That's always the best excuse, isn't it?
That's probably bad.
It's okay.
You can use mine if you want.
No. The spread between state-level respondents indicates that there is more perceived stigma in Pennsylvania than any other state in the union. That is really weird.
That blows me away. I mean, why? Why Pennsylvania, right?
Well, there's a lot of space between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. Let me say that. Yeah. And there's a lot of conservative views between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh.
Yeah. I mean, it's the scary part is kind of what we talked about in the beginning, is when there's so much stigma, people are much more in the dark, right? They're much more like, I don't want to reach out for help. I don't want my community finding out about this. And I run into that a lot where you know, I bring up going to 12-step meetings and – you know, I'll have someone say to me, like, I need to find like a town far away to go to a meeting, right? Or I need to go to the next town over because I'm scared that I will be seen going to a meeting.
Hey, I'd love to hear from some of our listeners and viewers. Are you afraid to go to meetings in your own community for fear of somebody seeing you? And, you know, the flip of that is, I think – if somebody sees you going into a meeting, they should be proud of you and say, look at this person's trying to do well.
Yeah, I think so. Right?
But that's not necessarily the case, is it?
It isn't.
You remember your first meeting? You were terrified to go in there?
I was in the Plymouth Meeting Mall parking lot just waiting in my car and being absolutely terrified for about 10 minutes, you know, until I got the courage to actually go in. And it's funny because over time you look back and you're like, why did I think that was so threatening? And I worried about people knowing too.
Yeah.
You know, people knowing because I was brought up in that stigma. You know. You can see how it's negative.
Let's go quick some roll call here. We got a lot of people. Michael Shoemaker, Tennessee. Karen Wright Browndorf is watching. We got her. Judy Hansford. Hey guys. Kathy Wolf Collins, Debbie Reynolds, C. Ruger. She says, that story you said seems a little fishy.
Is that what she said?
Yeah. Wait a minute. Steven Sussman, hello from Palm Beach, Florida. Monica McNally, Pacorni.
All right.
Rehabs for fish.
Yes. I mean, it is a serious thing. You know, it's a serious thing because all these streams are getting so much drugs in them. And these poor fish.
Can you imagine drug court for fish? I mean, would that ever happen? Monica would be able to, you know, tell us about that. Anyway, Ellen Schwartz is watching. Lawrence Miller. We'll get to the rest later. Look, we're laughing about it. It is kind of funny. But the problem is the end result can be you're ingesting or digesting chemicals in the fish that you're eating.
Yeah, and the poor fish. Like the whole ecosystem is getting messed up because, you know, not only is there, you know, other chemicals and toxins, but, you know, to have drugs in the mix is not good.
Right, right. Hey, let's talk about trauma. And we discuss that a lot.
Yeah.
You bring it up a lot. Trauma is a big contributor to addiction. Whether you know you've had trauma, you don't know you've had trauma, or you deny that you've had trauma, it's in the mix. Correct, Mark?
Almost always it's in the mix. And, you know, not only trauma that might have happened, childhood trauma and addiction go hand in hand. Right. You know, I forget the percentages, but it's really off the charts. Right. But not only during childhood, but when we're out in addiction, it's very traumatizing. You know, people don't really put two and two together. But, you know, you get people that, you know, they had to, you know, sell themselves to get drugs.
Sure.
They had, you know, going through the court system is very traumatizing. And, you know, so somebody gets in recovery. And they start thinking about this. They start thinking about this trauma, and it's really hard for them to stay clean. But, yeah, the two are so interconnected.
You know, I can look back on my own childhood and say there was no trauma. But yeah, that's impossible because I remember little snippets of things that went on in my house. Now, that I never identified them as traumatic back then. But as you said, thinking back, hey, maybe that did have some effect on me in later years.
Yeah, and that's, you know, because we have a lot of – we talked about denial earlier, but we have a lot of defense mechanisms that kick in as a child. And then sometimes that denial even hangs around. So you'll have somebody later on remember these instances and finally identify that it was traumatic. And, you know, people think about trauma as just – abuse, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is that sometimes, I mean, I had traumas as a child and mine was totally different. You know, my mom was super depressed, mm-hmm. right? And she went through, you know, she had lost her mom, I mean, her dad, and she was super depressed. And I was home because like my brothers were at school and she was probably up in bed. You know, I was downstairs in the basement watching Sesame Street, you know, but it, you know, if a parent is really depressed or a parent is not emotionally available, that's traumatic for a kid,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
that's traumatic. So it can come in so many different forms, trauma. Then later on, you know what a kid does in instances of trauma?
What?
Disassociates.
Listen, when we come back, we're going to go for a break. I want to talk about some trauma maybe in your family, and I'm going to try to figure out some trauma in mine so we can put a face with to our audience of trauma that, you know, nobody is excluded from that, I'm sure. So, listen, we'll be back, and we'll be back.
We'll be back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Don't let addiction rob you of one more day. Pocono Mountain Recovery Center offers comprehensive addiction treatment for adults. Depending on your unique needs, your care at Pocono Mountain may include detox, residential treatment, and an array of outpatient options. We also offer transitional living support and transportation for outpatient participants. Pocono Mountain is in network with most major insurance plans. Start your recovery journey at Pocono Mountain Recovery Center. To learn more, call 877-596-0223.
Hi, this is Simon Kirk, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, listen, everybody. If you need help, call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Line at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-4357. There is help out there.
There sure is, and don't give up.
And don't give up, right?
Don't give up no matter what.
There's no drive-thrus and there's no delivery services, but there is plenty.
And get it early.
Yeah. You know, we're talking about trauma. You know, I said, I don't know any trauma in my family, but, you know, I'm thinking back. I remember I must have been 5 years old. My father was taken to a psychiatric hospital and was given electric shock treatment. I was not told that until 10 years ago, but I must have known it in some way. It affected me, just that one instance, you know?
Very traumatizing.
As a little kid, to know that the back, the glass in the door was broken, people had to come in, take your father out.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't remember watching it, but I was told about it, you know.
And, you know, as a kid, you got to think of it from a kid's perspective. You know, parents equal survival, right? Like we're, you know, kids are powerless a lot of times to really take care of themselves.
Sure.
So to have a parent taken away like that, and you're a young kid, and you can only imagine the perspective and the fear of that situation.
Right, the security blankets.
The security.
Look, how many people in addiction, their parents overdosed and died? It could be both parents.
Yeah. Yeah, and here's the thing, is if you think about it, the kids don't have tools to cope with this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So what do? They disassociate. That's what we call it.
Yeah.
And so in other words, like, they think of like, well, what's the next toy I can play with? What's the next thing that'll get me out of myself, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And that is taken on into adulthood, right? And then it's like, what's the next drug I can do? What's the next, you know, to medicate the feelings?
Look, I actually wrote this down before we came on the air, and it works perfectly with what you're saying. We didn't get high because we felt good. We got loaded because we didn't feel good, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there was a little bit of both, don't you think?
I don't know. I can remember the day I started using pills. I know exactly where I was, and the person said to me, take these, you're going to feel unbelievably great. I guess I wanted to feel unbelievably great, you know?
So,
it was the Quaaludes.
Yeah, yeah.
Anybody out there ever take any Quaaludes? Give us a call.
Not me.
1-888-329-3306.
Not me, and I'm very happy about it.
I got to tell you, it was a great drug until it wasn't, like every other
substance.
Isn't
that the story?
Yeah.
Isn't that the story behind this?
Right.
I mean.
You got to be lucky enough to know when it isn't good, right?
Yeah, and not be in denial and not just that, to be able to reach out for help, right? So, and this goes deeper than just kind of saying that. You know, if you think about it, if a kid reaches out to help from their parents and their parents aren't able to help them because of their own addiction, mm-hmm. that trust is broken and they're going to have trouble reaching out for help probably for the rest of their life if they haven't learned how to as a kid.
And would it be more targeted, this distrust, to an age group such as their parents?
That's a great question. I would imagine that. As they get – I would imagine it would be pretty universal.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
It would be pretty universal. You know, again, putting yourself out there trying to get help and, you know, they're using. And, you know, kids aren't – they're not getting their needs met, right? So then they grow up and they're like – they're going through something and – they're kind of taught not to reach out. And this happens, too, in certain areas. Like we get a lot of times like, you know, somebody growing up in a city where it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And they have to be very guarded because of safety. And so they learn to really hold everything in. They can't show any kind of weakness. And so then they come in for treatment. And one of the first things we're working on is getting more comfortable with actually self-disclosing. Because for their whole life, they were taught that you don't show weakness. They see it as weakness.
Yeah,
you don't tell people what's really going on. And you can see how that interferes. Like somebody could be going to meetings, all the meetings they want, but not know how to really self-disclose because their trust has been broken over the years.
Yeah. You know, when I think about kids going to school and that appear to have a horrible – home life, it's heartbreaking. And it can never lead to anything good. I mean, I'm sure there's instances where somebody can pop out of that, but it's usually traumatizing. Right?
It is. And think about it. Like, that's what's so important about early intervention and having a trusting situation where the kids are able to talk about what's going on.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes, I mean, I know in my case, I was completely isolated when it came to that.
You were?
Oh, yeah. Like, in other words, I didn't even really – I mean, I knew something was going on, but I didn't – I was. It more came out as, like, a lot of fear.
Are you the youngest of all your brothers?
Yes.
So do you think – so you had some kind of buffer, I guess, with your older brothers.
Yes.
Do you ever talk to them about it?
Yeah. I mean, pretty much all my brothers have struggled with this because mm-hmm. there was a period of time, again, when she was super depressed. And that goes along with, like, anger and, you know, withdrawing from people, not letting you close, you know. And so we were all affected by it. And but thankfully, like, I had three older brothers that I could play with,
right.
you know, and
right.
that I could.
It was a distraction.
It was a distraction.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but I can't imagine, like, imagine these one parent households where you have a kid where their parents are sick and they don't have other kids around. I mean, imagine how traumatizing.
Or
scary
there's
a
money
is.
Issues where there's funds are yeah. limited. Can you imagine that feeling of desperation, fear, exclusion from other friends? I mean, embarrassment, everything. What
yeah.
does that do to you?
Yeah, it's. It creates, again, there's something called Maslow's pyramid, and it talks about being able to get into higher human functioning, you know, being able to love, being able to, you know, get into this higher human functioning. You need that baseline. You need the food, shelter, yeah. safety.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're running on what's called fight or flight a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
You're running on this whole survival mode. And when you're in survival mode, it's really hard to really get in touch with feelings, right? And
yeah.
it's really hard to share what's going on. And so it's definitely one of those things where those baseline needs are extremely important.
Listen, you know I want to bring something up because there's a lot of people, you know, trying to communicate with us. Ricky Trevain says, your cameraman is incredibly great. Brad, we wanted you to know that.
Thank you.
And you know what? Now we have a caller on the line. We'd like to take him. Mr. N, are you there?
I'm here, Mr. N, calling in.
Hey, Stephen, how are you, buddy?
I'm well. Stephen Clofine calling in and talking about trauma in my life.
Yeah, right? We've all – listen, I believe we've all – had at some level of it, Steve. And can you think of any, without mentioning any names, any kind of traumatic experiences you had growing up?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't so much for me when I was growing up. It's when I started using drugs. You know, I mean, I did have some issues when I was young, but I wanted to talk about my other issues.
Okay, whatever you'd like to talk about, Steve. Go ahead.
So the first thing was you were talking about Quaaludes. Quaaludes.
Quaaludes, Steve.
And,
you took enough of them. You should know how to pronounce it.
I took Quaaludes once from 1976 to 1990.
One time.
Yeah. That's a great line, man.
Every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still acted properly in my job. You know, I was in the real estate business for a long time, but my private life was totally out of control. And then I wanted to talk about trauma when I got sober on the day after my wife, Judy, was killed in a car accident.
Yep.
And the go ahead.
No, I'm listening, Steve. Yeah.
And the trauma for me, you know, was not overwhelming at that minute because I had been high for 26 years every day. And that was my first sober day in 26 years.
What was the date, Steve?
December 26, 1993.
Wow.
And I've been sober ever since. And
you're
just had a wonderful life.
You're doing great, man. You're giving back.
And,
you know.
you know, I'm involved in the program. I'm involved with my synagogue. I'm involved with my friends and my family. My daughter wouldn't talk to me when I got sober, and I did walk her down the aisle, and I have two beautiful grandchildren. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about something else.
Sure, go ahead.
So after 28 and a half years being sober, my third wife and I, Janice, have been together 13 years and just had a wonderful, wonderful life together. Beyond wonderful. And last summer, August 17th, we weren't vaxxed and we got COVID. And we were both in the hospital. I was in for 2.5 weeks, and Janice was in for 35 days, and Janice passed.
Yeah. It's,
so, yeah. You know, I have two wives that died.
Yep.
You know, Judy, who was my get-high partner for 15 years, mm-hmm. went through the windshield and hit a tree. And Janice, who was my sober wife in a loving relationship. And the last 6.5 months have been dramatic for me. But I want to tell you that because of my friends, because of the program and my sobriety, because of people like you, Gary, and your lovely wife, and, you know, the people I work with reached out and have just helped me so much. I'm in a grieving group. And I have a life coach, and I'm taking it a day at a time. And after 5 months, I'm back to work. And I'm 73 years old, and I'm back to work. And my life is sad in a number of ways, but also beautiful.
Steve, so, I know it takes a lot of courage to just say what you just said. And I can tell you this. It's you know, we talk about giving back. I don't know how many people are watching or listening, but I am sure that you have just helped at least one person for sure.
Yeah, well, I thank you guys. I love Clean and Sober and being involved with it.
Yep, yeah.
And I'll speak with you soon.
All right, listen, you hang in there, Steve. You're one of the special guys, okay?
Thank you. Peace and love.
Peace
hang
and love.
Hang in there, Steve.
Take care. Wow. Steve has an incredible story, you know.
Yeah, God, we're getting messages on the message board. God bless this gentleman on the call right now. May he be comforted and supported always. He just gave back.
That's beautiful. And that's true. You know, we say, you know, there's one thing to get clean. There's another thing to go further and get sober. And then there's a third thing to give back in any way that you can. And some people are giving back and don't even know they're giving back, like Steve in the call just now.
Yeah, he's – because, you know, it lets us all know in sobriety that we can get through the hardest things, life on life's terms, and stay clean through it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the message right there.
You know?
It's like here he is. Steve's going through this tragedy and, you know, he's taking it one day at a time. He's getting the help and he's getting through it each day. You know, and that just carries that message that this can be done, right?
Yeah. Oh, it can be done.
Yeah.
You know, that has to be the message. You can get into recovery. You know, all the stories we read and sometimes we read, it's all about horrible stories and horrible things happening. But there are so many great stories out there, right?
There are, and there's just a lot of hope. There's a lot of hope out there.
Okay, I'm going to bring up another thing somebody said. Wanted to talk about the concept of one day at a time. Okay, I have a little problem with one day at a time because look, yes, we have to live in the moment, but you know, I think about how many decades I have. I don't want to lose that, and it means a lot that I've been sober that long, and you too, Mark. Right? I mean, what's your feeling on it? It can be different.
Well, I love one day at a time. And I love the whole idea of staying in the moment, but I'm terrible at it. Does that, you know, in other words, like, you know,
I
you know, project ahead, think about the past and, you know, catch myself disassociating all the time. And you know, but I've been – it's funny because I keep trying to practice this whole – and it must be our ADD. We're probably both horrible at this. And, you know, usually what happens to me happens to Gary too. So, you know, I try it all the time. I try to stay grounded, you know. And I have to, like, make a real attempt at, like, just being in touch with the now. Because
very difficult, man.
It is. Why is that?
It's very difficult because we're thinking so much, so many things, and we can. I'll say this: I cannot compartmentalize things. Meaning, I can't say I'm having a horrible day, but it's really nice out. You know, it's all blended in my head. So the being in the moment, as you said, is sometimes very difficult because I'm thinking. You know, seconds ahead, hours ahead, days ahead. Yeah. What potentially can happen bad? It's usually bad stuff.
Yes, I knew it. We were on the same. So we do a lot of what we call in cognitive behavioral therapy, catastrophizing.
Yeah.
Where we look ahead and we're like, I mean, it's scary when you look ahead, you know? I mean, it's like, I mean, we're all going to get old.
If we're lucky.
If we're lucky. And I'll tell you, I mean, I really want to learn. I mean, Francis, I really want to learn this. Because I know your adrenaline gets going when you have a lot of fear going. And then it's really hard to just stay present. And think about what we miss, Gary, when we do that.
Yeah.
I mean, there could be nice flowers on the, you know, and animals. And, you know, here we are, like, thinking about, I have this to do. I have this bill to pay.
That's right.
I'm going to get old.
That's right. Yeah. Listen, Mark, we're very much alike.
We are.
It's not a good thing.
I think it's a good thing.
Hey, listen, Mimi Dorshu, like the ideas of the show today, you are both becoming rock stars. That's nice.
Thank you.
Laura Story, best thing I heard when I came into the program is people saying, let me love you until you can love yourself. That's a great concept, you know?
And think about it, Gary, if a kid is not getting the support from their parents when they're growing up, they start to think as a core belief that they're unlovable.
I'm sure. Right? Is that more for boys or girls? Do you think it's about this? What do you think?
I don't know. I think it's across the board probably.
Is it worse when a father doesn't give love? Or when a mother doesn't, or it's hard to say.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know the answer to that. But you know, it's like think about it. It's like, you know, kids growing up, parents hooked, parents or parents too busy to do things with them, and then they start to really internalize it and think I'm not good enough, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That core belief sticks around for their entire life. You know, unless it's really battled. And that's what the program does. I love that, what she said. We love you until you can love yourself.
Yeah, it's a great line. Listen, again, we're stressing this. If you need help, and this is what this show is about, give a call to the Substance Abuse Mental Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. It's important. If you're listening to us and you're starting to say, yeah, that sounds familiar to me and I'm struggling with that, give that number a call, 1-800-662-HELP. And listen, when we come back, we're going to continue with this. I have a couple other subjects I want to discuss, Mark, that I think our audience will find to be interesting and helpful.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
Hi, this is Rachel Leach of the Philadelphia Flyers. I listen to Clean and Sober.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
You know, staying in the moment, that's a tough, tough thing to do for people like us.
It really is. I mean, I try to meditate, and It's really hard. I imagine it's very hard for you, Gary. Meditating. Can you see Gary meditating?
I'll tell you what was very easy for medicating was very easy, you know?
But meditating, like the times that like I've been able to like just chill and meditate, they're very, very peaceful. You know?
Are they really? I know it works for a lot
of
people.
Very peaceful.
Brad, do you ever meditate?
I have.
You have?
I have.
I'll bet you Brad probably is like the ultimate, like he probably can stay in there. No?
Brad, turn it around. We need a microphone. Show everybody who you are.
That's a scary thought.
You've been doing this for a long time. No, turn it around.
Is that mic on? That mic's on, Brad.
Now he has no way of avoiding this.
Okay, so there's me.
Do you want me to hold the camera?
Look at that.
I can hold the camera.
No, that's I'm not giving you the
camera. Listen, Brad has the best hair of anybody.
He really does.
He's pretty good, too.
He really does.
Look at the viewers dropping off.
Actually, they're increasing. We're up to like 500,000 now all of a sudden.
Yeah, but it was 3 million before Brad showed his face.
No, but you guys made a good point earlier, and I was thinking about, you know, being in the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's tough being in the moment these days because the moments aren't – I mean, you can get pretty anxious about the moments with everything that's going on. So you've got to get into, as you were saying, you know, breathing – listening to the birds. I mean, you've got to get into the thoughts between the thought or the non-thoughts between the thoughts.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the thoughts are devastating at times. I mean, so that's the
There's a lot of feeling of helplessness, hopelessness, stuff like that. Another subject our audience wanted us to discuss. How do you choose a reputable rehab? How do you know where you're going into isn't less than idyllic, if that's a word.
Usually it's word of mouth. People know a lot of times, especially if you're going to the rooms, the ones that do good treatment, you know. But you got to be careful. You have to be careful because there's a lot of money in this and there's a lot of maybe not so reputable places out there. I always suggest, you know, really talking to an addictions therapist that has, you know, has some knowledge of where the which are the good ones, you know, in our area, right? Because you'll get some places that, I mean, you know, who knows what kind of treatment they're doing.
And patient brokering, where they send you out to bring people off the street in and give you a cut. You know, yesterday I spoke at a seminar at a university outside of Philadelphia. Actually, it was in Philadelphia. And the attorney general's prosecuting staff was there. And we were talking about this subject, about places that are that portray themselves as reputable that are absolutely not. And they're in the state of Pennsylvania, they are absolutely going after these places.
That's good news.
I mean, there was a place in Philadelphia. I forget the name of it. We can say because they're out of business. Something house. I don't know what it was called. That was – listen, these places are dealing with people's lives. You can't play games. You can't be doing this, you know, figuring out all different scams just to get money and the treatment is not there, you know. But as you said, if there's money in it, there's going to be bad, but there are plenty of great places out there. And I think your suggestion about talking to an addiction specialist is a really good idea.
Yeah, and we're really blessed in the Philadelphia area. You know, there's a lot of really solid treatment in this area, and it just really helps, you know. Really helps.
Yeah, yeah. But that's a big deal because there are so many places that have sold themselves out. Places in California, you know, once you leave here, you're not an addict anymore. Beautiful scenery. Yeah. All that stuff was crap, really.
Yeah.
And I think I don't see those commercials anymore.
Yeah, I don't either. And it's mega money, right? It's mega money.
Mega money.
Going after the money. And it's, you know, it's really what we kind of call blood money, right? It's blood money. So, but I am glad to see that you're seeing a lot of places like Florida, for instance, has really clamped down on this, you know, and the insurance companies are really taking a look at these places.
Yep.
And And, you know, it's getting harder to be in network, you know, and things like that. So it's definitely, there's some steps being taken.
They were telling a story of the Attorney General's office yesterday that this particular rehabilitation facility was sending in urine specimens, 5 a day for each one of their patients at $2,200 a specimen. This is the kind of stuff.
That's the old famous Florida model. It was happening all the time.
Yeah.
You know, where and guys, one thing you can do is look and make sure that they're credentialed with something like there's a credentialing board called CARF, C-A-R-F.
What's that stand for? Do you know?
I forget. I forget, but I'm sure somebody, Mimi will know what it stands for. But it's a special extra credentialing besides even licensing, where they come in and they really look at everything and they make sure it's really solid treatment.
Yeah.
And so the places that are CARF accredited is really important.
And this, you know, this issue of non-reputable places is across the country. It's just not in, you know, Pennsylvania. It is this problem, just like addiction, is all over the country.
It sure is. It sure is. And hopefully it gets better, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully it gets better. But what a concern about the meth, though, don't you think?
That was a big bust this week. Yeah, it's huge. I mean, 80 or 100 pounds of meth. How many people can that service? I mean, thousands and thousands plus the fentanyl. There was a lot of fentanyl. And they got them. They got these people. This was an investigation that started between the attorney generals, I think, of Florida, California, Pennsylvania, and they got these creeps.
Remember, we were talking about that a couple years ago about how this is coming, because it was mostly – I mean, it was much more active on the West Coast before.
Yeah.
And then it was coming east. But I don't know that it's ever been as bad out there in terms of the toxins out there.
Well, the fentanyl, right?
Yeah. It's crazy.
When did that – I never – you know, I never had any fentanyl. But and when I was coming down, it's basically, there was no drugs that could kill you that I remember. Maybe heroin, maybe. I don't know. Or if you took enough pills. But
yeah, the fentanyl, I mean, the crazy part about it is it used to just be – there not just, but there'd be batches of it, you know, where they would say it's bad dope.
Yeah.
A bunch of people overdose.
Yeah.
It's in the paper. And then – you know, it's another few months or a year until another really bad batch comes through. But now it's not just batches. It's all of it, which is insane.
And addiction is so powerful, audience, that you know it could kill you and you still go get it.
Yeah, especially dope sickness.
Can you imagine? You know, it's like having a revolver in your hand and spinning a barrel.
Well, and the crazy thing is the brain, the reptilian brain, is actually sending messages that if you don't get this heroin, you're going to die. That's what it feels like. I mean, like, that's how intense it is. So you can see how somebody's like, they're like, oh, well, I'm just going to go get high. I'm so sick.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Dope sickness.
Dope sickness. That's like a scary word, dope sickness.
It is. And from everything I've heard, I've never been through it, but I've heard it's many, many times worse than like the flu. And not just that, the part that people don't realize is the depression, right? So it's not just the physical. It's severe, sometimes suicidal depression, you know, coming off of it.
Yeah.
So.
Hey, listen, you know, we are coming up the hour. We hope the audience enjoyed today's show. I think we got a lot of information out. And, you know, even if we don't hear from the audience, I know you're listening and you'll take something away from this show like people take away from every show. And we thank our viewers. We thank our listeners. And remember, the bottom line is if you're listening to us and you need help, just call this number, 1-800-662-HELP. Very easy. And you can get some help. There is help out there.
It's out there. And I guess we all have to be careful. Spring's here. And sometimes that's a trigger for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. Call 1-800-662-HELP. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Hey, thanks for listening, everybody. To learn more about this broadcast, please join us on our mission at cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com. Have a great weekend.
Everybody wants to shine.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.